Tuesday, May 1st, 2018. Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours. Well, a lot happened in the one day I missed finishing my move into the new office, and I often point out how the most important news is glaringly absent from most mainstream channels, but never has there been a day where this is more apparent. Well, I take that back. I'm sure there are plenty of days where this is that obvious, but today is certainly one of those days. As we see discussion of Trump's doctors and Stormy Daniels, open attacks are being carried out on Syria, war between Israel and Iran is on the verge of breaking out, the U.S. presence in Syria is only emboldening despite claims to the opposite, we have cancer-causing chemicals in all of our food, radiation in our water and milk from Fukushima, as it's deemed worse than Chernobyl, and governments literally killing children. And no, I don't mean drone bombings, which are all too common and frustratingly ignored and dismissed by far too many as just another part of war, except that they tell us that we're not at war yet. All this and none of it can be seen on Fox, CNN, MSNBC, or any of it. But that's why I'm here. So let's get into it. For the first story of the day, coming from ZeroHedge.com, massive fireballs light up Syrian sky after Israeli strike. Dozens of Iranian soldiers reportedly killed. So originally, a journalist reporting from on the ground in Syria reported from an official military source saying, quote, a hostile foreign attack took place on locations in Hama and Aleppo at 10:30 local time on the night of the 29th, mainly targeting locations, positions with a strong presence of Iranian-backed militias, and with initial reports of mass casualties and injuries. Footage of the strike was uploaded and was apparently so big it could be seen for miles, and that airstrikes, quote, caused an earthquake measuring 2.6 on the Richter scale. Reports from journalists inside Syria have put casualties at close to 40 killed and 60 wounded, mainly Iranians. Yet this was completely ignored by Western media. And even until today, Israel nor the United States had not formally acknowledged the attack, and there was early speculation that it could have been U.S. coalition action in part. The Syrian newspaper, the Tishreen, reported on its Facebook page that the attack was carried out by 9 ballistic missiles fired from the U.S. and British military bases in northern Jordan. However, nobody else followed up and reported that same idea. But we're seeing a lot of different reports associating this with the U.S. and even Britain. And at this point, all of this was drowning in claims of misinformation and fake news, as we've seen every time in the past. Which all ended up being true, by the way. Even while Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said earlier this month his country will continue to, quote, move against Iran and Syria. And last Thursday, Defense Minister Lieberman vowed to strike at any attempt by Iran to establish a military foothold in Syria, despite the fact that Iran is allowed by the Syrian government to be in the country. This was the third such high-level Israeli attack on Syria within a month. And right after the attacks, we have Netanyahu claiming that he has proof that Iran is deceiving the world to secretly build nuclear weapons. Even the U.S. accidentally, they claim, released an official statement aligning with this accusation, following the Israeli claims, and even followed it with a supportive tweet that was quickly deleted, chalking it all up to a clerical error. Because within Netanyahu's revealed cache of documents that the Mossad apparently stole from Iran, it's clear that the information is both old and not indicative at all of Iran's current plans. But this is nothing new for Israel to cry foul of Iran and make false claims in an attempt to get the world behind them in demonizing and defaming Iran. However, it's always important to point out that Iran is no angel itself, as truly none of them are. I say that quite often. None of these governments are completely innocent of these kind of manipulations. But in this case, clearly they're on the right side of things, which is all that should matter at the end of the day, the facts on the table, what we can see and prove. And finally, after all of the misinformation and denials of claims of fake news, today, U.S. officials revealed that Israel was in fact behind the attack. Another article coming from ZeroHedge.com, U.S. officials, Israel preparing for war with Iran, seeking U.S. support. 2 days after enemy warplanes attacked a Syrian military base near Hama on Sunday, and nobody had yet claimed responsibility for the attack, U.S. officials stated that it was indeed Israeli F-15 fighter jets that struck the base. The officials said Israel appears to be preparing for open warfare with Iran and is seeking U.S. help and support. And that on the list of these potentials for the most likely live hostilities around the world, the battle between Israel and Iran and Syria is at the top of the list right now. That's a pretty alarming claim to make. And of course, after Israel attacks with impunity and with open, unprovoked hostility toward two sovereign nations, Netanyahu turns around and starts pointing the finger at Iran, worrying that it's about to attack Israel, as if that would even be unjustified, but claiming an Iranian attack was imminent and threatening responses. I mean, how absurdly juvenile to carry out an attack and then run behind mommy's leg that is the world stage, pointing back at Iran, saying they're about to do something we should all be upset about. This is how ridiculous things have gotten. It literally blows my mind to see the way this all plays out. Now, this to me also really stands out as an obvious setup for a false flag, as Iran is no doubt very aware of what a retaliatory attack would actually mean. So this very well may be the setup for a move on Iran as a fake attack is carried out, as has verifiably been the plan for Israel and the U.S. for decades. And even still, with U.S. officials acknowledging that this was in fact an Israeli attack, which is a very big deal, I would argue that little happens in this regard that the U.S. is unaware of or an integral part in. And even still today, this is nowhere in the mainstream channels. That silence is such a huge statement. It has to resonate with us in the larger picture. And in other Syrian news coming from antiwar.com, pullout unlikely as U.S. reinforcements arrive in Syria. While President Trump still talks about withdrawing troops from Syria relatively soon, the impression on the ground in Syria is very much that U.S. troops are staying. The Pentagon is showing no signs of rolling back deployments and is adding more reinforcements in the area. Over 2,000 U.S. troops are deploying at a dozen bases in Syria, mostly in the northeast. Reports out of the area are that the U.S. continues to expand the bases, building perimeter walls, defensive ditches, and helicopter runways. Despite President Trump's repeated comments, everything the Pentagon is doing gives the impression they are readying for more permanent bases and making no effort to ready for drawing down their troop levels. Again, this just has to touch back on the real idea that what we're being told on a daily basis from our politicians, from our president, from the administration, almost rarely aligns with what's actually going on the ground. And we've seen this talk about leaving Syria so many different times, even right before the recent attack. And you could make claims that, oh, well, we had to defend this or that or whatever the lies they were spitting. The point is that it never ultimately happens. And we used a fake false flag attack, whether they were aware or not. I think it's pretty clear that they were aware of it, that it wasn't real, and used that to basically maintain their presence in Syria. And I believe Trump is still kind of trying to throw this to his base and saying, oh, but we're still going to leave, when really we can see the exact opposite happening on the ground. This has to begin to be glaringly obvious that the United States is not leaving Syria. There's too much at stake here and too much at play in the geopolitical chess game. This is all a bunch of propaganda designed to make us think that we need to be there for some kind of moral reason, when the reality is they never plan to leave in the first place. Moving on to the next story coming from theantimedia.com, cancer-linked weed killer found in every food tested except broccoli. The FDA has detected significant levels of glyphosate, a commonly used herbicide, in a wide variety of foods, but it's unlikely the agency will release these findings to the public. According to internal documents obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request by The Guardian and the advocacy organization U.S. Right to Know, in January of last year, FDA chemist Richard Thompson wrote to colleagues, quote, "I have brought wheat crackers, granola, cereal, cornmeal, and from home, and there is a fair amount in all of them." Thompson, who is based in a regional laboratory in Arkansas, warned that the only food that didn't contain glyphosate appeared to be broccoli, which I don't really know why that's the case, but I found that very interesting. We've covered the idea of glyphosate and Roundup and Monsanto many, many, many times on this channel and written about it many times, and the reality of just the simple idea that it's basically in everything. We talked about the fact that it's in every single organic wine in Napa Valley, that all of Parliament had taken a piss test and it was in every one of their urine. Yet they always claim that it's in such small amounts that it's not dangerous, which is kind of a ridiculous claim at the end of the day, because we have to understand how many other things are happening simultaneously. But this to me is very alarming, that we're now seeing that it's in every single thing that we're eating. Now, his tests are part of the FDA's first ever investigation into how widespread Monsanto's glyphosate, the main ingredient used in Roundup weed killer, has become in U.S. food supply. Today, nearly 300 million pounds of glyphosate are applied to our crops every single year. The Guardian notes that because Thompson discovered its presence in foods during a test validating his analytical methods, quote, those residues will probably not be included in any official report. Even so, the outlet reported, quote, FDA chemist Narang Chamkazam, if I'm saying his name correctly, found over the tolerance levels of glyphosate in corn, detected at 6.5 parts per million. An FDA email states the legal limit is 5 parts per million. So think about that right there. There's clearly over the amount that they're claiming is supposed to be okay, the legal limit. It continues, quote, an illegal level would normally be reported to the Environmental Protection Agency, but an FDA supervisor wrote to an EPA official that the corn was not considered, quote, an official sample. I mean, it just goes to show you the ridiculous lengths, bending over backwards to make sure that the very clear evidence that shows you not only that it's happening everywhere, but that it's actually over the legal limit, to make sure that that information never gets out. Yet we find independent outlets like us and other people, the anti-media, openly talking about this. But until it reaches the mainstream, the vast majority will never even acknowledge this is happening. Wild conspiracy theories. We have to begin to recognize the real danger taking place here, how much of this is actually in our food and how prevalent it is, and not even just food. They've done studies showing that it's in cotton products. It's literally everywhere today. For 300 million pounds, I mean, think about how much that is and how drenched our food is in this chemical. And yet, and the studies we've shown about how it causes cancer, and I mean, it blows you away to realize how deep this goes and how far they're going to make sure you don't really ever see how bad it is. That has to stand out. Moving on to the next story coming from mintpressnews.com, Fukushima passes Chernobyl as worst nuclear disaster in history. Does anyone care? According to peace and environmental justice watchdog NukeWatch, the Fukushima disaster has overtaken Chernobyl as the worst nuclear disaster in human history. The meltdown at the Daiichi nuclear plant in Japan in 2011 is now believed to have released between 5.6 and 8.1 times more atmospheric radiation than Chernobyl. Despite the gravity of that revelation, the media has ignored the issue, kind of a running theme today. Many claim this is due to concerns that this revelation could bring down the fragile Japanese economy, which could have substantial global impact. Again, always kind of comes back to this idea of protecting the financial issues around all of this stuff and disregarding the health concerns. Last February, a hole measuring 2 meters in diameter was discovered within the metal grating at the bottom of a containment vessel built around the plant's number 2 reactor, allowing the reactor's fuel to escape from the reactor and into the surrounding environment. The hole permitted radiation inside the reactor to reach 530 sieverts per hour, a massive increase from the 73 sieverts per hour that were recorded soon after the disaster. To put these figures in perspective, NASA's maximum amount of radiation exposure permitted for astronauts over their entire lifetime is 1 sievert. I mean, think about that. And this is how much is pumping out every hour. That's alarming. I mean, clearly this whole story has been alarming from the very beginning, but there's clear efforts to cover this up. Clearly, whether you want to make it about the financial, the world economy issue, or just simply because they don't want to get revealed how negligent they were, even following it and how they dealt with it right afterward. This story disgusts me. And it really is a perfect example of how the people involved, the average individuals, are grossly misled with the sole intention of keeping the information from you so they don't reveal how corrupt they are at the end of the day. And this has to begin to stand out. This is all these stories today are really showing you that they will go to great lengths to make sure that you don't know what's actually going on. I mean, that's a running theme for my show forever, but it's something here today that is becoming shockingly apparent. Childhood cases of thyroid cancer have skyrocketed as well. However, some scientists continue to claim that there is no correlation between the increased rate of cancer and Fukushima, asserting that increased early detection tests in the wake of the disaster were responsible for the uptick, which I'm sure has some kind of a correlation there. But that's a shocking claim to make and a clear attempt to get attention away from what's really going on. This is despite the clear, verifiable, and globally recognized correlation of such cancers with Chernobyl. So it's interesting that they're willing to even make that claim. Consequences of the disaster have also been felt as far away as the United States, which is one of the reasons I think this is so important to bring up for people in this country. Soon after the disaster, radiation was detected in the drinking water of numerous U.S. cities and even in the milk of American cattle. Radiation of the West Coast, however, was noted to be low, and media outlets used this to suggest that there was no reason for concern, even though it was known at the time that levels of radiation would rise in the coming years. Despite that, the U.S. government does not monitor the spread of Fukushima radiation along the U.S. West Coast or around the Hawaiian Islands. Go figure. I wonder why they wouldn't monitor that. This ridiculous claim that these harmful things being below some arbitrary threshold for danger, I feel it's a way to placate the people, as these dangers are still very much present, even if at what they deem is an acceptable level, such as with glyphosate. This does not take into account all the other points of radiation and contamination that are compounding with this one level, that by itself, if never changing, which we know it is, may in their minds be safe, but add it all together, and we are seeing that outcome today, as one in every two people is predicted to have cancer at some point in their lives in this country. I would argue that that simply has become everyone, and that number is just the last grasping effort to make it seem like it's not every single person in this country is going to get cancer at some point in their lives. But even one in two, think about that. I mean, that doesn't just naturally happen. Everyone's getting cancer in this country, and that has to show us something. Really, what it comes back to is they make mistakes and take action with only profit in mind, and we're supposed to be okay with an acceptable level? No, zero is my acceptable level. And as they do all in their power to cover up these dangers and lie about their severity, we're supposed to trust their word on its threat level? I mean, when I and many others have said in the past that unless we do something about their careless actions, that it may be too late to turn back, this is exactly what was meant. Moving on to the next story of the day, coming from truthinmedia.com, reality check, the fight for Alfie Evans. Now, this is a story that we've covered in the past. When this really first started, we covered this a couple of times, and we recently put up an article by Ron Paul that discussed this and just how it really highlights government overreach in so many different ways. But this article was really well done by Ben Swan and his video that came out today about this topic, and really just broke down how this all happened, and actually highlighted one point that really shocked me. I mean, it didn't shock me because of the fact that it happened. I mean, we've talked about this kind of topic, which we'll get into in this discussion, happening many times. But in this discussion, in regard to Alfie Evans, that this was part of the story, it really did shock me. And I think it's going to shock you as well. So really, the story starts where Alfie's doctors, at a certain point, decided that continuing to keep him on life support was not in his best interest, which I think is ridiculous right off the bat, concluding that he had an untreatable, progressive, neurodegenerative disease of unknown origin. Alfie's parents did not accept the doctor's conclusions, arguing that the hospital had rushed to judgment. In court hearings, they said they felt the hospital had, quote, given up on Alfie. And so the hospital turned to the Family Division of the UK's High Court for a ruling. But the UK court ruled against them, deciding that life support, quote, compromises Alfie's future dignity. I mean, what does that even mean? His future dignity? I mean, this story it really frustrates me. The more you read on, it's going to get even worse. His parents filed an appeal, but it was denied. So they took the case to the European Court of Human Rights. There, the appeal was deemed inadmissible, why would it be inadmissible? I don't know, but it was actually deemed inadmissible. Alder Hey Hospital refused to allow Alfie to be transferred. They determined continuing treatment was not in Alfie's best interests. I mean, every time these statements are made, you should just be going, what? Not in his best interest? How is that even possible? So not finding any other possible treatments, not in his best interest? How is that? I mean, it just doesn't even make sense. They're contradicting as far as I'm concerned. Now, Alder Hey Hospital said scans showed, quote, catastrophic degradation of his brain tissue, and that further treatment was not only futile, but also unkind and inhumane. Now, I mean, I'm sure somebody could make an argument right there for why that might be the case. And, oh, it's just going to be probing and prodding him. But this is where it gets into the point where I don't see it as being their choice. How is it even possible that the state can tell the parents that you can't try anything else because we deem that it's inhumane and unkind and futile? I mean, this is where Ron Paul's discussing the fact is this gross government overreach where they can tell you what to do with the life of your own child. As Ben Swan says, the right to fight for life. It's absolutely crazy. Now, Alderhey Hospital decided that they would no longer treat Alfie, that he would be removed from life-saving ventilation. But they also determined that no one else would be allowed to treat him. No other hospital, no other doctors. Now, that's, again, the same point. That's where this begins to get frustrating is that, so fine, if you're claiming that you don't want to treat him anymore, that's your prerogative, which I still think is disgusting. But to tell the parents that they can't then go seek other treatment is, I mean, it's just, it's disgusting. And it shows you the hubris they have, like saying that, well, you know, and I actually think it comes into an issue of like liability, that they're more concerned about being sued or made to look bad that somebody else cured him when they couldn't or something like that, that they literally chose to let this child die. Now, even worse, now this is where it gets really crazy. Back in 2001, this very hospital admitted to taking organs from live children and selling them to a pharmaceutical company in exchange for cash. Now, I know that some people are going to immediately be like, that can't be true. This is exactly what they admitted to. According to the Guardian article, quote, just days before the publication of a report on the removal and storage of hundreds of children's organs at Alderhey Hospital without parents' knowledge, it emerged that supplies of the thymus gland, which is routinely removed during cardiac surgery to give better access to the heart, were regularly handed over to the pharmaceutical company Aventis Pasteur in exchange for cash donations to the hospital. I mean, think about that. I mean, this is not only is this a profit motive to steal organs, or I mean, you could argue whether it's stealing or in this regard, it's something they were going to remove, but to take someone else's organ like that and sell it off for profit, it gives them a profit motive to do so in many cases where it might not be necessary. I mean, that's something that I always point out in this regard, that you give them a profit motive, of course they're going to, when it becomes a fine line on which way to go, they're going to choose to take it out because they can sell it and get money from these pharmaceutical companies. And this also gets into a very alarming, you know, conspiratorial perspective here that many are going to reflexively dismiss. But we've talked about the idea of these black market organ sales and the way that things like this happen, where you know, even getting into regard to children being kidnapped or trafficked over in other countries in order to sell. I mean, this is a huge market, organ sales. And we have to understand that this thing really does happen. These things really do happen. And so then you have to ask yourself in this regard, if there is some way playing a part in the decision to allow him to die. I mean, and that's just a hypothetical possible discussion to have. Nobody needs to freak out and say that I'm making irrational claims. But the fact that that's possible has to be acknowledged. And this story, with this addition to the story, I think this is a very, very big deal. It's just something that has to be acknowledged. And especially with a hospital that gets caught for doing something like that. Why their moral choice to keep to allow this child to die should be justified or even acknowledged is beyond me. I can't even wrap my mind around this story. And sadly, in the final aspect of this story, they ended up pulling the plug on him. Now, most expected that he would not be able to keep breathing on his own, which was kind of one of the points of the hospital. But defying expectations, he did. And he survived several hours without assistance, yet sadly passed away this last Saturday. So, I mean, this entire story from start to finish, it has to upset you when you really understand how this all played out. Even if the parents would have taken him somewhere else for him to die somewhere else, that is their choice to make. The moment we get into this idea where the state has a higher authority under your own children, under your own healthcare, that highlights everything we're always talking about, everything we're always warning about. And this is where it comes down to, where they're literally telling you that they know what's best for you. They know what's better. Not just they know, but they're going to enforce it on you. That has to be alarming to us all. And it has to kind of be an insight into where this kind of thing is going. And at the end of the day, when anyone's child is let to die simply because the hospital either wants to use things they couldn't otherwise, or to not lose face in the fact that somebody else could help them, or even just for a possible liability, that has to show us where their real intentions lie. And it had nothing to do with helping that child. Moving on to the final story of the day, and to shift to a positive note to end here, coming from the freethoughtproject.com, Seattle voids criminal records for pot convictions, giving people a second chance. Seattle is making a landmark move to wipe out decades of marijuana possession convictions, effectively giving a second chance to hundreds of people whose lives were ruined by the drug war. officials have filed a motion in a municipal court that will retroactively void all misdemeanor marijuana convictions in the city. Now, it's a start. I mean, clearly it's only misdemeanor convictions. I would argue that a lot more of that could be potentially wiped out, that the idea that there are plenty of people simply because of having large amounts of marijuana are still in prison. That's something I think is just as, it's basically equal, whether you're arrested for having a gram in your pocket or having a pound in your house, it's marijuana. And I would argue that it's basically the same thing. So this is a very good start to see, and I love that this is beginning to happen. According to a statement from Mayor Jenny Durkin, the request would affect 542 people. The city has also requested the dismissal of outstanding misdemeanor possession charges. In her statement, Durkin acknowledged the lives ruined by the drug war and went so far as to call this move a, quote, important step to right the wrongs of the failed war on drugs. That's very nice to see, because it's important that we begin to acknowledge not only that we're trying to shift in a new direction, but that the policy up until this point has been fundamentally wrong. Even more so, I would take it a step further and say knowingly wrong, that there were other reasons and other motives, again, a profit motive, for why this has been perpetuated. And I think that's pretty apparent to most today. But nonetheless, this is a very good step in the right direction. As the author finishes in the article, it seems that the war on drugs has finally begun to unravel. Politicians, desperate to end up on the right side of history, are now making the right moves to remedy some of the problems. Unfortunately, however, as Jeff Sessions' career illustrates, there are still plenty of dinosaurs in suits willing to cage people for a plant. So as we keep winning these battles, it is important to stay on point, because the war is still far from over. For more information on the topics discussed, make sure you check out thelastamericanvagabond.com or any of the important independent sources in the show notes below. And as always, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.